LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Much about Halloween. You thought no further than the strange custom of having your children wear masks and go out begging for candy. It was the start of the year in our old Celtic lands, and we'd be waiting in our houses of wattles and clay. The barriers would be down, you see, between the real and the unreal. And the dead might be looking in to sit by our fires of turf. Halloween. The festival of Samhain. The last great one took place 3,000 years ago when the hills ran red with the blood of animals and children. Sacrifices. Part of our world. Our craft.
Witchcraft.
To us, it was a way of controlling our environment. It's not so different now. It's time again. In the end, we don't decide these things, you know. The planets do. They're in alignment. And it's time again. I do love a good joke. This is the best ever. A joke on the children. Happy Halloween. You don't really know much about 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 Halloween.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is James Swagger, who joins us to discuss the origins of Halloween. Before we get into that, I'll just mention that aside from the main website, which is LegalizeFreedom.com, that's Legalize-Freedom.com, and you can spell Legalize with an S or a Z, you can follow us on Twitter at LegalizeFreedom, that's spelt with an S, and also find us on Facebook, Legalize Freedom, of course, as a media, news, and publishing page. I'd also like to make a book recommendation. If you find today's show interesting, you may well enjoy The Way of Weird, a 1983 novel by Brian Bates, which tells a tale of Anglo-Saxon spirituality and the neglected Scandinavian and Germanic aspects of our psyche. You'll find a link to the Way of Weird website on this interview page. Turning to today's show, most of us know little or nothing about the origins of Halloween. Beyond trick-or-treating, jack-o'-lanterns, and the piles of plastic bats and skulls that go from supermarket shelf to landfill in a matter of days, Halloween is by and large a mystery. Some possess a vague awareness of its ancient past, but the profound connections with nature and the cosmos from which our age-old rituals arose have been erased from the collective consciousness by centuries of religious persecution and secular humanism. Delving deep into the dark past, we attempt to dig up the almost fathomless roots of Halloween, from the Christianization of Samhain and other pagan festivals, to tales of sacred bonfires and bloody sacrifice, and legends of a liminal time when the veil between the real and the unreal would be swept aside. We also reflect on how modern mediocrity has twisted the heritage of high antiquity into a hollow cipher, a state-of-the-art bastardization that has transformed ancient rites into retail opportunities, vile and vulgar shadows of the ineffable and eternal. But all is not lost. Beyond the Celtic revival, neo-paganism, Wicca, Druidry and heathenry, the primordial power of ages past is rising once more in the collective consciousness. Disillusioned with the false promise of globalism, the mendacious lie of materialism, and shaken by the crumbling foundations of techno-industrial society, human beings the earth over are seeking something better. Slowly at first, but with gathering awareness, we are rediscovering our birthright, long buried and forgotten.
Hello and welcome, James, and thank you so much for joining us once again on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Thank you, Greg. Great to be back. It's been too long, Greg. It's been too long.
It's been at least a couple of years, probably more,
actually.
Is
it that long? Oh, wow. Yeah, I've been monitoring what you do, Greg. I love the show. You've done some great interviews, and I do check in from time to time, but it's great to be back on here for this special.
Well, it was around about when your book was published, actually, so, and obviously you've been very busy as well, but you can plug all your various channels and websites and all the rest of it at the end. Today, sure. As you mentioned special, we're going to be talking about Halloween and how it is not what it seems, the origins and all the different aspects surrounding it. Before we get started on that, just for people who don't know, tell listeners a little bit about your background and work in general.
Sure, Greg. Thank you for that. Megalithic research is what I'm into at the moment, and it's all encompassing a few different things. I do a bit of podcasting, as you mentioned there, and it's kind of how I got into that, was doing megalithic research, meeting people at conferences, and I'm self-confessed, like, you know, obsessed with megaliths. I want to know the answers, and I want to know, I had a vocation as an engineer and a scientist, and I've come at it from that angle, and I know a lot of architects or engineers or mathematicians or scientists or and lay people too, you know, that they're all flocked to these ancient monuments trying to figure them out, because it's a big mystery, Greg. It's a big mammoth mystery, and it's encompassing everything from shamanism, acoustics, astronomy, mathematical codes in their geometric shapes and hinges, and there's several elements to their structures that they left us. Another one is artistic expression. You know, we need artisans and engineers and every other person in between to look at these megalithic monuments. And I know you said we're going to talk about Halloween today. It does have a tie-in, and it does link back to megalithic times. It's kind of why I do shows like this at this time of the year, Greg, because in one respect, it's great to do a timely show, and it's also to correct the nonsense that goes on out there. And, you know, it's the same for Christmas as well. I mean, you look at the origins of Christmas and the solstice and Christian and paganism, and it's just a big soup of collection of misinterpreted data, confusion, and ideology all mixed together. So hopefully we're going to unravel some of that today. But primarily I'm coming at this from a megalithic astronomical perspective, and I want to talk about the real Halloween and why it's shifted to a different date, and then the customs. We can get into some of that as well, but largely this is all based in a ritual, and it's all based in science and facts, which most people don't realize. And the origins goes back to Ireland and Scotland, and the Scottish people, I'm talking about the Western Isles, the people on the western half of Scotland, they originally came from the north of Ireland anyway. So when we talk about Gaelic, Scottish, and Gaelic Irish. We're talking about one group of people that dominated those isles, the Western Isles, and so that's what we're really going to talk about today: the Irish and Scottish origins of Halloween from megalithic times onwards.
It's interesting to think just of Irish people moving to Scotland, because when I think of it, I think of it the other way round. You know, later on, you know, centuries later, with the plantation and all the Scottish people moving back to Ulster, and the influence that has had. For example, my own surname is Scottish, which would suggest that, you know, the derivation there is from some, you know, Moffat in Scotland.
I lived in Moffat. I lived in a place called Moffat in southern Scotland near the Scottish-English borders in Dumfries and Galloway, funny enough, Greg.
Well, that's where the name comes from. There was a clan Moffat, and they were based around there. So there's been a lot of back and forth, and
And funny you say that, you know, the Scottish plantations of Ulster, as they call it, you know, the migration came back the other way. However, when they came back, there was a mixture of English and Scottish and Gaelic Scottish too. And now today, I mean, the Scottish that are what called Gaelic Scottish, they speak a different dialect too. So they're well segregated from their origins in Donegal. Most people don't realize that even from where I'm situated in central Northern Ireland, you can see 50 miles out to sea in the Isle of Islay from my nearest mountain, and the nearest crossing is up in Antrim, and you can see Scotland 16 miles across. So you can see, for the half of the north of Ireland, you can see Scotland on a clear day. So the migration's always been coming backwards and forwards. But like you're saying, when the plantations and they came back again, the cultural diversity was a bit more mixed. But however, there was a reverse migration. It's funny, isn't it, that it come back around. And that brought with it, and we may be touching this a bit later in the show, that brought with it, you know, a different regime. And again, Christian and paganism, it was all, and there was a clash again of Irish mythology versus, you know, this Christian, or whatever Christian divide we're talking about, but a Christian clash, if you want to call it that. And bizarrely enough, where you're from in the north of Ireland, Greg, not too long ago, we had a statue on the mountain with its arms open to the sea called Manannan Mac Lir, who was the son of Lir, basically. Manannan, where the Isle of Man gets his name from. There was a statue facing out to the North Sea along the north coast. It was a statue depicting Manannan Mac Lir, who was also the son of Lir, obviously. And that Lir was a sea deity, a Celtic pagan sea deity that they all worshipped, one of these semi-divine gods of ancient Irish. And again, the clash from one side of Northern Ireland just ripped the statue down because they don't like their ideology. The ideology is still strong here, on both sides, and one trying to, you know, clash with the other. So that was only a couple of years ago, Greg, funny enough.
Well, that's funny. I didn't know this because...
It's on the BBC. I have an article on it. I'll send it to you.
About 3 years ago it was, I went up to look at the thing because it's such a nice view from up there. You could walk right up to the statue. It wasn't that big. And people are thinking statue. It's not bronze or, you know, cast stone or anything like that.
It's heavy.
It was some kind of resin type stuff, you know. I don't know. But I didn't realize that. So that's been smashed. Oh, well, there you go.
Well, they actually carried it 300 feet to try and take it away like a trophy. But it's a beautiful place there. It's actually where they film Game of Thrones. You may or may not know that.
Mm.
But it's absolutely beautiful. I mean, we've had the Northern Lights there recently, and people will see the statue that we're talking about. If you just Google Northern Lights, Northern Ireland, you'll see where we're talking about, the headlands of the north of Ireland, Giant's Causeway, all lit up with the Aurora Borealis, and you'll see the statue up there, the iconic statue that we're talking about. So powerful a deity today, it's like red rags to a bull. People from the other side just don't like the strong ideology. And people in Ulster, Greg, we're always a bit different from the rest, right back to ancient times. There was always something different about the people in Ulster. They lived in a harsher terrain with the mountainous region, because most people don't realize that the north of Ireland is mostly mountainous, the 40 peaks of the Sperrins. And they were, you know, the four provinces of Ireland, that's Connacht, Leinster, Munster, and Ulster. Ulster was always seen as a force to be reckoned with, and that's who Cú Chulainn and the defender of Ulster. They were also more bolder and braver, and we also have the Cooley raid where they robbed the bull and from the west they brought it to Ulster as well, and it's like a cattle raiders from ancient times. There seemed to be a whole lineage of a story about this, but there was always primarily a focus on Ulster and the north. Personally, I think, and you know this from your territory as well, I think Northern Ireland, or the whole of Ireland, was conquered from the north. We have evidence of that, Mount Sandal and Coleraine. We have settlements there going back to about 8,000 BC, Greg. So that's the oldest settlements we have on record, Mesolithic. So it's a deep antiquity here, but there's always been a lineage of the sea, and always something kicking off in Ulster from ancient times, even before Christian denominations came in and clashed in the 1600s.
So if we go back all those centuries, millennia even, into some of the dark ages, for want of a better word, that you're speaking of, what's traditions in there? What is it that begins to come together? If we trace back ideas of Halloween, where does it lead us into the dark past? What is it that begins to form that we end up with today, this transformed, unrecognizable thing?
Yeah, well, most people from a pagan perspective will always say to you about Halloween is when the veil is at its thinnest, and that bit does survive. That bit has been known since ancient times. So there are some remnants in there that have some core of truth, and I'll explain that in a moment. But, I mean, pagans do have some idea, and it still stupefies me that pagans will celebrate this on a Christian day. It's like, get with the program. If you're going to be pagan, be pagan. Celebrate this on the real Halloween, which is the 4th of November. And I'll explain why that is. Basically, Halloween, or what we call in Irish Gaelic or Scottish Gaelic, is Samhain or Samhain. Scots call it Samhain with a bit of a twang on the end of it. But Samhain or Samhain. And in Gaelic, that means the month of November. And it basically means Iha Samhain is the night of November. Iha Samhain is Halloween in Irish or Scottish or Gaelic. And Iha Samhain is basically the night in November. In other words, the special night in November is, there only is one special night in November. And that's the 4th of November, and that's the astronomical day of Halloween, the real Halloween, if you want to call it. And basically, it's the halfway point between autumn equinox and winter solstice. Now, that might seem like a no-brainer, and you go, okay, well, there wasn't just one of these days, there was four of them, and they're called cross-quarter days. In other words, they're halfway points between solstices and equinoxes. And these have been revered since we have the megalithic record going back 5,000, 4,000, 3,000 BC era. And all these ancient monuments have these alignments encoded into them. They were obsessed with worshipping the solstices and the equinoxes in a ritual sense and in an astronomical sense. Now, Halloween is one of four days. They had sister days of Beltane. Everybody will know Beltane, or Beltane as they say in English. But Beltane means the month of May in Irish. And the night in May is May Day. What we call the 1st of May now is called May Day, but it's been bastardized into that, and it should have been about the 3rd or the 4th astronomically. Okay, people don't unlike the number 4 and 3. They run and, oh, let's make it the 1st of the month. That's easy to remember. In the same way, we have St. Brigid's Day on the 1st of February. It's actually called, the festival's called Imbolc, and it's a cross-quarter day. That should be about the 3rd or 4th of February. Again, it's the halfway point between winter solstice and spring equinox. And then we have Lunacy, or some people in England call it Lugnacy, because they don't understand the G silent, but nonetheless, Lunacy, or the Lammasphere, celebrated in Ballycastle and Antrim today. You may know that one, Greg, being from Northern Ireland.
Oh, yeah, but go along, get bags of yellow, man.
Oh, yeah, bags of yellow, man, rocks, for sure. But The festival, again, is to celebrate the harvest, or the harvest day, and this should be the 3rd or 4th of August, but people celebrate it as the 1st of August. Now, you might think I'm pinpricking small points over astronomical days. I'm just giving you what it should be. I'm going to refer people to jamesswagger.com, hit the Halloween tab. I've got graphs up here on how you break this all down. It's nice to see a graph and the data in person. So basically, you have the four special days of the year: spring and autumn equinox, and winter and summer solstice. Okay, And the halfway points in between those, again, is Beltonit, Lunacy, Imbolc, and so on. And that so on is just one of those special cross-quarter days. Personally, I think that the cross-quarter days were more important, Greg. These were more revered than the other days. The other days of summer solstice, winter solstice, spring, and autumn equinox were very easy to figure out. Okay? Because number one, summer solstice, longest day of the year, very hot day. You have a physical, two physical qualities there, the longest day of the year and heat. Okay? Winter solstice, shortest day of the year, cold. You've got physical qualities associated with those 2 days. Okay? They're very easy to figure out. You put a row of standing stones or sticks or a line of sights on the horizon. Sun rises in the east, sets in the west. Okay, eventually you'll see where that sun is throughout the trajectory of the year. It's very easy to measure. You just put observations year after year. And then the summer solstice, the winter solstice, you'll find out it's the shortest, longest day of the year. And then sun rising in the east, sets in the west. You'll both figure out the equinoxes, spring and autumn, where days are of equal length. So these days were easy to figure out, but the cross-quarter days, you have to do a calculation. You have to measure the halfway point. That's a little bit easier. That's not a little bit harder to figure out. However, once you get through that and you understand what these guys were celebrating these days, I mean, they still, up in the Shetlands, they still celebrate May Day up there at Beltane, where they have offerings of fires and stuff like that. And they have bonfires on those days too, another tradition associated with Halloween. So they probably had bonfires on all of these days, Greg. However, we're only looking at this one that survives. And the reason we're looking at the one that survives is because there was a massive effort by the Christian church to shift this day. There was more of a connotation put on this day in a human perspective, because this was the day when the veil was at its thinnest. I mean, the harvest day, okay, they harvested the crops on the 3rd and 4th of August, okay, the Lunacy or Lammas day. Once you start mentioning spirits and the dead people or people who have passed or connecting with the other side, it's a different regime. It's a different entity in itself. So this is why there was so much connotation put on this day. There was a human perspective where death, ritual, which goes back. I mean, don't forget, when we're talking about megaliths, we're talking about people who put massive building constructions into these special days. And, ritually, ceremonially offered the remains of the dead in urns, treated them by cremating them outside, collecting their ashes, putting them in ceremonial urns within a shamanic process, and a ritual offering, and put them into these tombs, of which Loch Crew Cairn L, for example, in County Meath in Ireland, still has this Samhain alignment. There's actually evidence on Loch Crew, and I go into this a lot in the New Grain Serious Mystery. I go into a lot of this, that I think they were trying to really refine these cross-quarter days. Like I say, they're harder to calculate because, they're like arbitrary days in one respect. But you don't mark the exact middle of summer solstice. It may be easy to measure the summer solstice with the longest day and it's hot, or the winter solstice the shortest day and it's, but they're not a significant day in terms of a practical sense. This very start of summer and the end of summer is a different thing. The start of autumn and the end of autumn. The start of winter and the end of winter. The start of spring and the end of spring. They're the days that are more important, and they're the cross-quarter days. So they have because their starts, ends, that's where the cross-quarter days are probably more practical or more useful or more ceremonial or more ritual. Who wants to measure the middle of summer? I mean, it's okay, that's great. You don't celebrate the middle of summer. You know, people do today in reverence of the pagan times. However, to the pagans, they ritually celebrated the coming of summer, Beltane, May Day, and the end of summer, the harvest, Lunacy. They celebrated the becoming of the end of autumn and the start of winter with Samhain, which we get a really cold snap around the 1st of November, by the way, and it's got this connotation with it as well in terms of a physical sense. And then you have the end of winter coming at the start of spring in Imbolc. So they have more of a meaning, I think, in a ritual sense. So this is kind of the megalithic solar wheel, as I call it. Solar wheels, by the way, think of it as an eight-spoked wheel, eight spokes of a wheel in each one of these days: spring, autumn, summer, winter, and then the halfway points in between. Some people give them English names, some people give them Irish Gaelic names, but these cross-quarter days and the other 4 days make up what's known as an eight-spoked solar wheel. These solar wheels are all across cultures. That the Pope uses them. Pope Benedict's got them. The Knights of Malta has them. And if you even look on jamesswagger.com on the Halloween page, you'll see the Knights Templar cross within that spoked wheel. I drew it that way for a reason, and I coloured it in so that you could actually see the Templar cross in there. It's there. You can just, it stands out when it's drawn to your attention. But the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the cultures, they were obsessed with these solar wheels as well. And all aspects of the Roman Catholic Church have this embodied in their worship and their rituals. Egyptians, the Dogon. I mean, solar wheels were all over the ancient empire. The Hittites again. Again, this idea of a solar wheel is carried through. So just so you know the background in a megalithic sense, it's in science, it's there, you can measure it, you can quantify it. It's not just this magical day, it's actually 4 days that were very important to these people in a cultural ritual sense. And then you have this focus on Samhain. Let's just talk about the etymology of Halloween. This is important for people, Greg. You know, it means Hallow's Eve. It's a amalgamation of two words, Hallow's Eve or Halloween. It comes from this Christian festival of Hallow's Mask for the All Saints. And, All Saints Day is on November 1st. All Souls Day is on November 2nd. So the Eve of All Saints Day, Hallow's Eve, is basically October 31st. It's been celebrated since about the 7th to 9th century. It's a bit murky when this became All Saints Day. Therefore, if you fix All Saints Day on November 1st and the Eve is Halloween, they fixed it on that date for a reason. There's evidence to suggest that they had this massive effort to Christianize the pagans of the British Isles. And Europe, for that matter, but successfully in Europe. I personally think unsuccessfully in Britain and Ireland. I think their effort to Christianize the pagans, I think it was the other way around. I think they adopted so many of the pagan customs into Christianity in an effort to get dialogue and get conversion going, that they ended up absorbing so much of the pagan element that they got converted to paganism. You could argue it either way. But there is evidence that All Saints Day was originally around May. And we know that from records in Talla, actually. That's the place in Dublin, by the way. 835, it's been officially labelled the 1st of November, but we know that from testimony of others that in places in England and Germany, they were already celebrating All Saints Day on November 1st. So, Louis the Pious, he fixated it on 835 as All Saints Day, November 1st, and he was probably just putting into practice, putting on paper what was already in practice, basically. Pope Gregory, the fourth, he lays down November 1st. That's kind of when All Saints Day is labeled. It was to take the focus of the pagans, attachment to what was really their, you know, sacred day. And one of their sacred days, one of their four sacred days, Greg. So, in a way, they were successful in getting the focus off Halloween. However, you know, the pagans still go and celebrate this day today, this special day, and other days at these monuments. I mean, ritually today, these megalithic monuments on these celebrated days, these cross-quarter days, people go and tie offerings up their clothing or strings to the trees, or, you know, they have offerings to the sacred trees that are growing at these megalithic sites. And they still ritually go and use them in a pagan sense, even though they're a highly Catholicized country. You know, it's like they still have both customs running simultaneously.
Just thinking back to the megalithic connection again, there's at least one passage tomb at the Hill of Tara and God knows where else, but that was aligned with the Samhain sunrise. Now, I don't know if you know anything about that, but I'm just wondering, based on what you said, well, on what day? November the 1st, November the 4th, if you see what I mean?
Yeah. It will actually happen. If it's aligned to Samhain, it's also aligned to Beltane. If you go, I have a special diagram up for this because it gets a little confusing when you start talking about compass alignments or azimuths. So basically, if something is aligned to the sunrise on Samhain, it's aligned to the sunset on Beltane. If it's aligned to the sunrise on Lunacy, it's aligned to the sunset on Imbolc. So these cross-quarter days, there's a double alignment. You'll have a sunset on one day and a sunrise on the next. So it's like, they're like double alignments. The place you're talking to, by the way, is called the Mound of Hostages on Tara Hill. That's the nickname. It's called the Mound of Hostages. I don't know where he even gets that name from. It's a relatively small mound. It's got nice rock art inside it. And, so it's aligned on the 4th of May, excuse me, and it's aligned on the 4th of November. Astronomically, but you will get the event a couple of days either side. I was recently, there's a place called Beltane Stone Circle, gets its name from Beltane, in Irish, Beltane, or Beltane in English as people call it, but it's aligned to the 4th of May. However, you'll still see it on the 1st of May, so it may be a pinpricking on a bit of specifics, but don't worry. I mean, if you're going to see an alignment, you'll see it 3 days either side of it, easy. The sun doesn't do that much radical things a few days either side of an alignment. Same as Newgrange, you see the sunbeam coming in on the 21st of December, but you'll get it a couple of days either side. Depends how deep that sunbeam is going to penetrate into the chamber. For the sake of the Mound of Hostages in the Hill of Tara, you'll probably get it 3 or 4 days either side. It was a special one, and it shows you that the reverence for this day. Don't forget, you must realize that what they were doing with these passage tombs, that they had a passageway, a beam of sunlight would come in on an alignment, they would ceremonially burn their cremate the remains of the dead outside and bring them in. So we have souls passing over, bodies being burned, cremation ritual, bonfires, alignments, days, special days. It's all there. It's all there when you just open your eyes and go, oh, megalithic stuff. It's, you know, it's not just one random day. It's the 8 days of the year. There's actually evidence that they had a 16-month calendar, that they further broke those cross-quarter days down to halfway points again, therefore creating a 16-spoke wheel or a 16-rayed semicircle showing a 16-month calendar. There's really strong evidence for that, Greg. I go into that in Calendar Stone, which is also appearing at Loch Crew as well. A forerunner to that was at Loch Crew. And everything at Loch Crew, there's so many of these megalithic chambers up there. They're all targeting either Beltane, Lunacy, Samhain or Imbolc, or Spring, Equinox, Autumn Equinox, and they're trying to really fine-tune this 16. There's so many of them up there, too, so many different alignments. It's hard to even say which one was a Samhain sunrise or a Beltane sunset, or they may have targeted both days. They may have been aware of that. And that's probably why they developed that calendar for 16 months, because they were naturally gravitating towards it, Greg. They were doing this in a ritual sense, naturally splitting up the year into four quarters, spring, summer, autumn, winter, and then splitting that again into these special days and having ceremonial functions around it, having some sort of a physical meaning of start of summer, you know, end of summer, start of winter, end of winter, and again, further breaking that into a 16-month calendar seemed natural for them. It just seemed, you know, break it down again. They were already watching cycles within cycles, because when you break that into an 8-spoked wheel, like you just mentioned, You're going to get a Sawan sunrise, and you're also going to get a Beltane sunset on the same day, on the same alignment. And I have those alignments on for the people there, as people can see. They're strange azimuths when you get into the cross-quarter days. Well, a point worth noting, though, there's something special about the British Isles, Greg, that these alignments, so the sun rises in the northeast and sets in the northwest on summer solstice, and it rises in the southeast and sets in the southwest on winter solstice, and spring and autumn it rises due east and sets due west. Now, that's the four, I mean, I put down the angles and the compass point there, so north, south, east, west, northeast, northwest, southeast, southwest. You've got a perfect compass in the British Isles by the sun. That's why this sun wheel was so important to these guys. That's why I've drew it like a sun wheel, with the north, south, east, west, northeast, northwest, southeast, southwest. Although the cross-quarter days, when you break them down, have funny angles and azimuths. They must have known that, and they must have known there was a double alignment there. Sunrise on one day was sunset on another, and they must have been aware that by ritually matching out the Sawan alignments and the Imbolc and the Beltane and the Lunasa, or Lammas, that they were watching a double alignment that was coming back to itself again. That's what these guys were in the business of doing, watching sunbeams coming in and alignments. So they were solar mapping. They were mapping out the solar year with lots of different intricacies and then building rituals around that. It's incredibly interesting.
It's interesting thinking about the Christianization, or there was attempts to Christianize these, you know, events and places and times and other things of significance. It almost seems naive in one way if you zoom out and look at the bigger context, because some of these, you mentioned solar wheels in the context of other cultures, going back to, well, as far as we can see into history, and who knows how far back beyond what we've so far managed to glean. And this idea of a liminal time, you know, as you mentioned earlier, the veil between the real and the unreal, the material and the afterlife being at its thinnest. I mean, this sort of idea of another side, it goes back, as I say, into high antiquity. And it's almost like and other religions have done this and other movements as well, but the Christianization idea was that if this persists, then people are not going to accept our narrow doctrine and our narrow view of how things are. So you have to somehow attempt to, and you saw this with invaders going around the world as well, you know, the Spanish in South America, attempt to stamp out these very, very old traditions. And as you say, in doing so, certainly in the British Isles, it seems to be like, oh, hell, just change the names.
Yeah. Well, bizarrely, okay, let's mention, we have a unique perspective in Ireland, okay? Let's bring in the Christians at the moment. We're talking about monks here. From the 6th to the 9th century is an incredibly unusual, interesting period in Ireland and Scotland for that matter. And well, we had the monks that were trying their best to Christianize the local pagan populace. Okay. The only way they could do that was by dialogue. You're not going to convert somebody. You can go wipe a culture out. Yeah. But converting them? That's a difficult thing to do. And they had all these pagan gods and nature spirits. And that's great. Okay, we'll talk about that in a minute. However, how do you convert people that have this? You're going to have to talk to them. You're going to have to take their customs and give them your own custom and mix it in. And that's what they tried to do. Bizarrely, the effort to Christianize them ended up in them preserving their culture. And what we're going to talk about is we'll talk about all the Irish texts that we have. There is nobody, and it mentions the megalithic stuff. We have a barrage of ancient Irish texts. There's the Leabhar Gal na hÉireann, the Book of the Taking of Ireland, or the Book of Invasions, as it's also known. We have the Book of Leinster, the Annals of the Four Masters, the Annals of Ulster, Book of Ballymote, the Book of Banshankas, Dinshankas, the Book of Fermoy, the Voyage of Bran, the Book of Armagh, the Rawlinson manuscript, I believe, is kept in Oxford somewhere, the Book of Lismore, Annals of Tigernach, Annals of Inishfallen, the Irish Annals. These books just keep on going and going. So I mentioned some of the best ones or the most known ones. They were all from the four corners of Ireland. They were all written down in several different epochs, But usually within that time period of 6th to the 9th century, some later ones that were falling apart were rewritten down and recopied. However, this story was collected by the local populace, and the stories that they had, their oral histories, I should say, never deviated by 95% of the story. I mean, they might be 5% slightly different, but for the best part, they're all talking about the ancient peoples of Ireland, whom the Celts inherited these monuments from. And these people were known as the Ishi or the Tua de Danann, divines and semi-divine gods and demigods, which was about 70 figureheads, Greg, of two different dominions. There was the Fomorians, which were semi-divine. They were supposed to be giants in stature, or the Ogs, as some people call them. And then we had the Tua de Danann, which were the people of the mounds. They later be known as the Ishi or the Dinishi. She means a mound in Irish, by the way. So the Banshee was the woman of the mound. Ban meaning woman. She means mound, the woman of the mound. And she, that's a nickname, what we call a witch in Irish. So the Banshee was the witch or the woman of the mounds. So we have, all these different, the Tua de Danann and the Ishi are basically the same. And this is to come back to the other world, by the way, Greg. I'm telling you all this. Is that from all these Irish tales, now there are other groups of people in there. We have, the Parthalonians, the Numidians, the Milesians, or the Sons of Mill, and they were supposed to be Spanish, and the Fir Bolg. So there was other groups in there, but there was two of these groups that were semi-divine. And they were supposed to have otherworldly powers, supernatural, or able to go to the other world on the other side. And it's at this time of the year, this was written down by monks, by the way, and written down very well. I mean, they documented all this stuff. I don't personally think they knew or understood it. I think they were like the Dogon, Greg, when Marcel Guyon and Germain Dutrelin, went to live with the Dogon for 20 years, they wrote down everything they told them. And they didn't get it, they didn't understand it. Had they have understood it, they probably wouldn't have wrote it down. It's that simple.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And in the same way, I think the monks doing the same thing, just, they documented everything. I mean, the Irish didn't have a written language at that time. They had a rough Ogham script or Ogham script, English called Ogham, Irish people called it Ogham script. And it was a series of runic dashes. It was only 400 known examples of Ogham script in the whole island. And if you only have 400 examples of writing, it's not a writing system. People say that there was parchments of bark with all the Ogham writing on it, with all the ancient records of Ireland, and they're now being lost. Perhaps they'll turn up in a bog one day, who knows, but for the best part, when they tried to convert this Ogham script into what's known as modern Irish Gaelic, and this Latin alphabet Irish, so they did that, and they therefore developed the Irish language alongside preserving the Irish oral history of Ireland. So much so that these remnants of these books, by the way, every book corroborates the next book by the story. If this was only one book, people would go, well, somebody made it up, blah, 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 gone, done and dusted, end of story. However, what we have is multiple books, fragments of books, or sometimes only a page or a fragment survives, sometimes a complete book survives, but they always corroborate each other. Not every book corroborates, there's a mixture of books, a mixture of stories, but sometimes you always have three or four versions of this, Greg, turning up, and being preserved. So the point is, the monks did this. Had they have known that there was a group of people talking about 70 semi-divine gods, you know, and a lot of what they wrote about was the Ishi. Now, this got revived in the 18th century, so much so that the Ishi or the Dinishi and the people of the mounds, they were known to have gone, they could go to the other side if they wanted to. They were described as being very, very beautiful people, or sometimes hideous or ugly. Bizarre that they talk about them like this. The Ishi were somewhat supernatural, that were always affiliated with this time of year as well. And this brings it back to Halloween. That the Ishi, they tried to the pagans perhaps lost the true meaning of what the megalithic monuments were. They inherited them, by the way. They didn't understand the practices. The two of the Danann or the Ishi were supposed to have retreated to the mounds. And where the history ends and the mythology begins, or the misinterpretation of the actual history becomes mythology, who knows? It's such a gray area, Greg, that it just blends into each other so naturally. But these Ishi, this is what the time of year was all about, that they thought that the Ishi were going to come and take their children. They thought that, you know, these were ghostly beings, that they were from the other world, that they could take them, and that this veil was at its thinnest point at this time. They knew there was something happening at this time of year. Perhaps astronomically we go around the sun, there's a different electric magnetism hitting the earth. Who knows? Maybe there's a physical reason for that. I like to think there is. I just know that if you think about it in a scientific sense, as we go around the oval trajectory of our path around the sun, we sometimes get close to the sun, we get further away, then we get close again, then further away, then close again, and then we have the tilt of the earth, getting sometimes tilting towards the sun and then tilting away from the sun. And that gives you your perfect sine wave going up and down of a change in electromagnetic radiation coming towards the earth. And it's a perfect sine wave going up and down and up and down as that sinusoidal tilting of the earth plus the oval trajectory you can map out coming, waxing and waning, going towards and away, towards and away. So perhaps there is some sort of a electromagnetic phenomena going on where the veil is thinnest. That's the best that I can describe it in somewhat megalithic, scientific, and then also ritual sense. Great.
This is really important. I think you've really hit on something there. This electromagnetism, we have cosmic rays bombarding the earth constantly, mm-hmm. passing through our bodies, through our minds, into the center of the earth. To say nothing of the trajectory of the solar system around the galaxy, which obviously takes, you know, infinitely longer, and that exposes, well, all the bodies in the solar system, but for our purposes, the earth, to all sorts of different influences as it passes around. Now, of course, in our lifetimes, or even in, you know, the last 10,000 years, the solar system has barely moved around the galaxy, but it does happen over very long periods of time. Mm-hmm. And I think this is very significant. If we look at the effects that electromagnetism, like artificially generated on this earth, can mm-hmm. have on us, good, oh, yeah. good and bad, you know, there's, I think this is very, very important.
Well, you know, I'm not a ghost hunter. I don't do paranormal, nor I don't even do paranormal shows that people want me to. I just don't, I'm not into it, but I do know that they talk about ghosts and having electromagnetic phenomena. Perhaps we do, and perhaps this is a time when this, you know, they this has been said that, don't forget that the Samhain stroke Halloween alignment is also matched with the Beltane alignment. That's why they like bonfires in both of those days, Greg. That's why I say we still have that reserved up in Beltane in the Shetlands, and but we also ritually do it on Halloween as well. And the lighting of the was to guide spirits away, the bad spirits away, you know, as a protection. That's ritually what it's meant to do. I don't know if other countries do that. They probably have laws about making bonfires, but seemingly we seem to have this thing in England and Ireland that we could still go and have bonfires on Halloween if we want. We seem to just burn whatever we want. So,
well, you've got that tradition in certainly in Northern Ireland, which has got nothing to do with any pagan festivals or anything like that, of just lighting bonfires just for troublemaking, you know.
Just for fun.
Yeah, just related to sectarian issues, you know.
Sure. Its original custom was to protect against spirits. This was seen, you can understand this Beltane, we shouldn't really call it a Beltane Samhain alignment, that these 2 days of the year was seen as a liminal time, this transitional or a process. We went through this process, like it was like a window we were going through, where we're opening the gates to the other world. And they were trying to protect against that, and the way they did that was, you know, there was almost, it turned into a fear. This may have started off as a megalithic cultural practice, was a scene of maybe a time of talking to the other side, that may have just disappeared and people got confused and maybe it turned into a fear where, oh my God, we don't understand that. So when people don't understand things, they seem to fear it. So they could have kept the bonfires alight and saying, oh, we must light the bonfires to protect ourselves or something like that. They were afraid of their kids being taken by the Yixi, taken away. And that's where the custom of wearing the masks on that day, so that they couldn't recognize their souls or their faces, that's where that custom comes from. That's preserved all around the Celtic empires. We're talking Brittany, Isle of Man, Cornwall, Wales, Scotland, and Ireland. We all have remnants of these. This is a Celtic, pagan custom that's survived in many forms. The pumpkin thing is preserved as turnips and, or Swedes, as some people call them. And they're carving out the, not necessarily pumpkins, but they carved out turnips or Swedes in the Isle of Man and other places. So the ideology and the customs are pretty strong and pretty similar all across these Celtic dominions, Greg.
Yeah, in fact, if you go into, as I did yesterday, go into any supermarket and go to an aisle that used to have something else in it, I don't know, cheese, and it's now full of plastic bats and skulls and all this other garbage, a lot of that's what people think of when they think of Halloween in the 21st century, particularly in North America, can be traced somehow back to something, as you mentioned, the turnip and the Swede, was pumpkins, because they've got those in the USA and generally we don't grow them here, you know, and yeah. Never did.
Yeah. So, yeah, and again, great that you mentioned that as well, Greg, because what we have now is you've got all these, it's like a Chinese whispers. The whole idea of Halloween is just like Chinese whispers. You say something to one person, by the time it gets reverberated to 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 people, you know, you go into double figures, then it comes out something totally different at the other end. And what you have is you got a megalithic astronomical ritual practice being handed over to the Celts, who at their very earliest point was 1500 BC, most likely about 1000. The last known megalithic monuments we have were about 1000, possibly 800 BC, but no later than that. So we have the megalithic culture dying out. That's sometimes even just, we have, the only thing we have in a written literature is the Irish monks that writ down this stuff from the Celts themselves. So, you know, we're interpreting the rock art into an astronomical sense. We've got Irish tales of mythology, stroke oral history. And what you have then is these Celts then, you know, evolve themselves, so that by the time these Celts get to around what we know as the Dark Ages, the custom is just going off in its own tangents. Fast forward that into Christianity then coming in and then taking over the Celts and trying to take their pagan customs away and slapping on a Christian spin on it. And then you have this, you know, everything's evil if you do it this, and everything's good over here if you come to Christianity. And it's like they just try to really push that already misunderstood confusion into a real, you know, freak show. So there may be just a normal astronomical practice, like a shamanic astronomer doing some sort of a practice inherited by the Celts, misunderstood, twisted by the Christian church, and then modern times kick in, they just turn it into a whole custom festival, and other countries adopt this thing all around the world. Look at when the British Empire expanded its borders, it just brought its customs with it, and it brought its practices and rituals with it. And as a result, you're looking at this global thing now, where most people don't even know that the Irish and the Scottish is the origin of this festival, never mind its true nature.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned the everything becoming bad, you know, and the idea of the these Christian evangelists, which is basically what they were, and that, you know, human nature is a little bit more nuanced than just the Ten Commandments. And I remember Anton LaVey saying, well, maybe it was not him, but someone like him saying the Ten Commandments is basically everything that people want to do, being told not to do, you know, every urge that we have. But you can see this playing itself out, certainly in the 19th century, and earlier than that, you know, in North America, for example, where the Puritan tradition meant that the modern version of Halloween, more or less as we know it, was kind of sort of prohibited for a while. And I think it's ironic now that the plastic, shallow Halloween experience of modern times, where all these powerful symbols of ancient times have been reduced to sort of hollow ciphers, is at its most prolific in North America. They really go for it. I mean, it's the second biggest type, you know, thing of its type in America after Christmas.
Mm-hmm. You know, don't get me started on Christmas, by the way. Hey, I'm not a party pooper. Like, I've got nieces and nephews, and I love spoiling them on Christmas, and it's great. You know what? Why does every... I watch people in the UK and Ireland cripple themselves financially for Christmas, and it's like, what are you doing this for? It's like, why can't you tell people you love them? Why can't you celebrate your family every day? Why can't you do it once a month? Why can't you, you know... Why do you have to do all this exuberant material on one day of the year and then leave yourself null and void for the rest of a few months trying to play catch-up? And why don't you constantly provide and give something? Because it's been subjected to them. You know, Christmas is this one day of the year, and kids are going to be happy when you give them all this material goods. It's nonsense. It really is nonsense. And it all stems again from a December 21st alignment, which the Christian church, you know, they have all this ritual solar worship around. So it's no different than the Halloween thing as well. The only difference is there's so much more financial aspect put on Christmas than the Halloween. But the Halloween is big business, like you say, and it's like, it's just nonsense. Don't get me wrong, though. I want to mention the pagans. I mean, we have neo-pagans and Wiccans and all sorts, and I'm not going to speak badly about them or disparagingly. I mean, each to their own. Everything evolves. The Celts were evolving themselves in culturally, being absorbed into their ancient Irish Gaelic, with the monks being trying to show them literacy. And so the Irish Celts developed, and Scottish Celts developed in their own way with their literature and stuff. But again, they were evolving. So, but in the same way that the paganism was evolving too, so much so that, you know, you had druids, sometimes called the Men of the Oaks in England, that the Druids were like a splinter group then. Like Druidism, if you want to call it that, in England kind of was much different to Druids in Ireland. And it seemed to maybe take on it maybe split into a darker role. So I came back from the British Museum and I got a chance to see the Celtic exhibit, which was showing the art and identity. And in there was the Gundestrup cauldron, which depicts Cernunnos, the horned hunter of the night. And in one hand he's holding the serpent, which has got a coil on it, and he's grabbing it by the scruff of the neck, basically. And on the other hand, he's holding the torque. And this is just screaming shamanism. It's like this big giant cauldron had some sort of a shamanic brew in it, and they were ritually worshipping this. We know that right back to megalithic times, that a lot of these ceremonial urns had hallucinogenic compounds in them. Some of them were for putting the remains of the dead in, and some of them had some sort of a compound in them for either ritual drinking or, this could have well been some sort of an ayahuasca type compound, mushrooms, whatever. These guys were probably taken, that's probably why we see so much serpent mythology, all across this megalithic and Celtic. And we have serpents in Gavrinus, megalithic tomb, by the way. And we have the Celts inheriting this stuff, these monuments, and showing all this serpent mythology. So these guys were probably taking some sort of a compound, going to other dimensions and portals within their own mind. And that's probably, they probably did it at this time of the year. They probably had, it's what they call it, the Vine of Souls, ayahuasca. I mean, they were meeting their ancestors. We know from megalithic times in the hypogeum that they were going in there ritually to revisit their ancestors. They had 5,000 remains in there. They were doing that in a shamanic setting. They had acoustics kicking off in there, trying to explore altered states of consciousness. They had fractal art on the ceiling with hexagon stuff and entoptic phenomena. You know, these guys were exploring psychedelics and acoustics in these monuments, going into altered states of consciousness. And perhaps maybe that effect is ramped up. I spoke to psychics that say that they sense this more around this time of year, that they feel this different pool of energy in that they can talk to the other side much easier. Maybe that's because of electromagnetic effects. I don't know. I mean, I just know that there's something kicking off at this time of year and that there may be something to it. And maybe they took something to help them do that. Maybe they took compounds. Certainly, I think with the Gundestrup cauldron and Carinunus, it's really depicting some sort of a serpent worship, which we know is associated with ayahuasca and other stuff. So, I mean, I just think that this Christian pagan evolution, even within the pagan monument, even within the pagan practices that lasted through the Middle Ages onwards, that it evolved in its own way with Wiccas and neo-pagans and still evolving today. You got orders today that are trying to revive an ancient Druidism. And you know what? They may not have all the practices, off to a fine art. They may be making some of it up. Who knows? But they're trying their best to preserve ancient customs. And they've always affiliated this stuff with megaliths. So it's bizarre. I'm not going to crucify people because they're some sort of a new pagan type group, or they're not the old pagans or whatever. You know, it's they're evolving in their own way as well. So just in the same way, the megalithic monuments evolved. 4000 BC, they were a bit more different than the 1000 BC monuments. So everything evolves over time. It's just the shifts were megalithic to Celtic to pagans, pagans then to Christianity. And now we've got this modern stuff trying to shift it totally into a new era.
Well, yeah, you're talking in part there about a revival. You know, you mentioned neo-paganism and the Wiccans and their sabbats and what have you. And it's really quite an exciting idea, the idea that some form of meaning, even if we don't really understand, even if our ancestors didn't really understand what their ancestors left them, that some kind of meaning could be imbued back into these special days. People say, we're living in a sort of this, you know, postmodern age. We've got no need for that stuff. But there's persistent interest in this, isn't there? Whether it's from the Celtic revival around Victorian times or the phenomena that you mentioned now. I mean, Druid orders are very much alive and kicking. And it's almost like as we've moved through the Industrial Revolution and our technological age, that we've been left feeling bereft of something. And I think in some of the topics that we've touched upon, it touches people in a way. It captures their imagination. There's something primordial about it that kind of speaks to them. And that, I think, that impulse within us is what religious types in century and millennia gone by were so worried about, that we were in touch with something above, below, behind, beyond, wherever you want to place it, something bigger than us.
Oh, for sure. Just to wrap things up, and I think paganism can be good and it can also be ritually used in a bad way by a group of people who want to adopt customs for their own ill-gotten gains, if you will. And you can call that Satanism or witchcraft or whatever. There is good aspects to paganism too. There is harmless rituals celebrating astronomical days with offerings and all sorts of good. I mean, there's people saying that the bonfire was actually a bone fire, that they would ritually slaughter people and put them on a fire. But bone fire could come from the cremation of someone who already died and ceremonially putting their... That's what they did. We know they didn't cremate them inside megalithic tombs. We know they cremated the bodies, chopped them down a large chunk of wood to do it, to get it reduced to ash, and then ceremonial offering inside and a very careful ritual offering for their deceased ancestors. There was great care taken. So, I mean, do people use this in a sense today, paganism? I mean, look at the Christian church. They have a deep ritual pagan thing going on. I mean, and then there are dark groups out there that will take aspects of paganism and associate this day of the year with something negative, nasty, or, you know, some sort of a dark ritual. I'm sure there's all that goes on too. But, It gets more complex the time goes on. So I just think that hopefully I've done some service to kind of explaining it. Yes, all that stuff goes on. But there's modern connotations on something that had an ancient practice. And you got to just open your eyes and look at the data. But it's not been given to people. It's been given from our lenses, from our cultural perspective, looking into the past, where we need to look at the evidence and see where it got, you know, shifted into our cultural perspective, basically. Look from the other way towards where we're at today.
I often wonder, I mentioned this in a recent interview, actually, how the future will regard us. You know, what sort of mythology are we making? What of our rituals will be 1,000 years from now, 10,000 years from now, and they'll talk about us and what the things that we did, and if we were there to look on it, we say, that's not what we were doing.
Yeah, I know. God only knows what they will turn us into. I mean, you would probably sit back and go, oh, my God, what have they done to us? Where they've deified us into some, you know, they could deify an iPhone or something. Who knows? Like, you know, who actually knows? And it just shows you what happens with cultures. But I think if you're aware of how things morph and how things evolve, customs, rituals, you know, I think you just got to be aware of that and how that happens, and look for the root cause of things, whether that's etymology in words or whether that's the origins of a custom or its true sense. You know, people just need to wake up sometimes and look at this stuff. I do think it's incredibly privileged that we have a lot of the story still preserved there from ancient Irish texts that I mentioned. And I hope some people check them out, because they're all online for people to come at there. And the Celtic mythology is rich in a lot of this folklore, if you want to call it that. And a lot of the astronomy and the megaliths is still there. And it's not a major reach for people. It's all there, and all the customs there. You can actually see very clearly how it's all morphed and evolved to the learned scholar who wants to do a little bit of research that's needed.
And I just, a closing thought from me, I hope that people will ponder this when they are at a Halloween party or bobbing for apples or setting off fireworks or whatever, burning tires. Who knows that there's beyond this, before this, there's something powerful, there's something potent, something real that had meaning and purpose for a very, very long time. And there's nothing to say that that can't be somehow rediscovered, because it comes from within us and from within the world around us, whether that's on Earth or whether that's the cosmos. It's part of something, the real, you know, this wasn't just invented. It's not a theme park, you know, despite what it may have been turned into.
Well said, Greg. There's a significance to this. There was a serious ritual style custom. And there was, you know, there was something of special importance to this day, and now it's just turned into, like you say, a theme park. And I just think if people are going to just, you know, do something on this day, have a little think about actually what it all means. But I'll wrap it up on that. JamesSwagger.com, you can check the Halloween page I put up there. There's not a hell of a lot there, but I did put the diagrams up and just explain it to people in a graphical sense, in an astronomical sense, and will you even get the points of the compass from these four special days of the year and the cross quarter days. And this, again, it's not just one day, Samhain, Halloween. It's actually 4 days. There's four special days, the cross quarter days. And I think if people are going to at least look at Halloween, look at the 4 days, because they seem to have forgotten the other three. So most pagans will be aware of these other days, but at least it's still somewhat preserved in somewhat mixed sense. But that's all I got to say anyway. JamesSwagger.com for myself as an author. You catch my radio show's podcast there, but the Halloween page got a bit of background information.
Fantastic. Well, James, thank you so much for joining us once again on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Thank you, Greg. It's always a pleasure speaking to you.
Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, check out the website, which is LegalizeFreedom.com. That's Legalize-Freedom.com. Where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including politics and economics, energy and environment, culture, spirituality, history, and the nature of reality. You can also browse and buy a range of publications from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Whether you listen, donate, or do both, I greatly appreciate your support. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com.